Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. There are a lot of things to be concerned about in terms of the threats we must protect against if we are to ensure the survival of our country. And as we head into this Memorial Day weekend, it is a time to reflect on those threats, to be clear-eyed about them, and to my way of thinking, to be especially mindful of something that this day calls us to think about every day. And that is not simply the sacrifice of fallen heroes, but also the importance of practicing what my old boss Ronald Reagan used to call peace through strength, so as to avoid preventable wars by deterring them effectively, and to assure that we can win decisively those that we cannot avoid. A man who is the living embodiment, to my way of thinking, of the principles of peace through strength and the commitment to protect the country we love, I'm very proud to say, is a regular here at Securing America. His name is Sam Faddis, Charles Sam Faddis. He served our country in numerous capacities, including notably for 20 years as an undercover operative of the Central Intelligence Agency, putting his life on the line day in and day out in some pretty unsavory places to, well, use our strength to preserve the peace. Sam Faddis is these days an author of, among many other things, Substack articles for AND Magazine, and we're going to talk with him about several of them that are of surpassing importance, and I'm very pleased to be able to do it with you today, Sam, on the eve of Memorial Day. Welcome back to Securing America, my friend.
Great to be here, Frank, as always. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me ask you first, Sam, about China. We had a webinar yesterday about what has been developing in terms of evidence that the Chinese are not simply intent on attacking Taiwan, conquering Taiwan, attaching Taiwan to the mainland, if you will, but they may have in mind doing it rather imminently. There's a video out of Guangdong province, apparently, that suggests plans are now underway at the direction of the national leadership in China for presumably not just Guangdong province, but all of them to make a transition, as it's put in this video, a top secret recording of a meeting of senior party cadre and military officers to make the transition from, quote, normal to war, unquote. Have you had a chance to look at this video? And if so, do you think it's authentic in terms of what it represents?
I have watched the video and read the English translation of the Chinese, and it certainly seems authentic to me. It also seems completely consistent with everything else we see Beijing doing right now.
Yeah, that's really a key point, Sam, because I don't know that we'll know for sure that it is authentic, but it does fit into an awful lot of other, what they call in your business, indicators and warnings that China is moving inexorably towards conflict. In our webinar, Sam, and I don't know if you had a chance to take a look at it, but it's now at presentdangerchina.org for the rest of you to watch, and I hope you will, that the Chinese have quite possibly got more than Taiwan in their crosshairs, including us. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that's exactly right. We wrote about this not so long ago at AND Magazine. Look, the Chinese clearly intend to expand, are expanding. They, occupying the South China Sea was not a defensive measure. That is a springboard to allow further action. You know, they've got targets out in the desert that are the silhouettes of our major naval warships. They've got a new hypersonic missile they call the Guam Killer. These are what we call clues in the intelligence business. I don't think there's any reason to think that the Chinese would simply move against Taiwan or elsewhere and then wait for the Seventh Fleet intact at a time of its choosing to come and, you know, launch some sort of counteroffensive, assuming we did. The Japanese didn't do that. In 1941, they decided, let's go sink the U.S. Navy first, and then we will do as we wish in the Pacific. Why would the Chinese not do the same thing? Why would they move on Taiwan and allow us then to choose how we will respond? I think they would begin by striking at the number one enemy, which is us.
Yeah. This was a subject of the conversation we had yesterday. Jeff Nyquist, one of our colleagues on the Committee on the Present Danger China, which, of course, you are a prominent member, talked about a defense minister about 20 years ago in China by the name of Chi Hao Chen, who in another recorded presentation to party cadre, talked about the United States as being the principal target. A lot of talk about Taiwan, but they understood that we are the main enemy and we must be taken out so that they can realize their ambitions towards the island of Taiwan, yes, but also more broadly. In fact, he talked about biological warfare being used by the Chinese to depopulate the United States and enable their colonization of it. Are you familiar with this speech, Sam? And does that fit your own experience with, among other things, you know, sort of the biological warfare piece of weapons of mass destruction terrorism, which you used to be responsible for at the agency?
I'm familiar with the speech. And look, I think you should assume that the Chinese would strike at us at the outset of a conflict. They will not let us choose how to respond. And they will attack us in any way possible. They have never accepted that biological weapons, chemical weapons are off the table. They explicitly say that the only reason those treaties exist is because we want to preserve our dominance in other spheres. That, and it's a Western plot, basically, to keep them from being able to fight us.
Even though they are signatories to these agreements, as I understand it, you're saying that they don't feel that they're constrained by them.
No, not at all. Completely meaningless. And particularly you look at some place like Guam, which is one of our principal bases in the Western Pacific, right? If you attack and you bomb and you destroy jets and crater runways and so forth, okay. If you use biological and chemical weapons on Guam as well, I'm just using this as an example, think of the area denial implications of that. When you're now trying to put that place back into operation, but you're now dealing with chemical and biological threats, whole different ballgame.
It is indeed. Sam, we have to take a short break here for just a moment, and I want to come back to sort of the problem of biological warfare, pandemics, and the like with you in a moment. But suffice it to say, we'll talk with Michaela Dodge a little later in the program about the Chinese nuclear threat. But one thing that I think is a consideration for them that argues for using biological warfare, maybe in a place like Guam, maybe in a place like the United States mainland, is that you don't destroy everything. You just kill the people. And if what you hope to do is to use it as Lebensraum, as the Hitler used to say, or colonize, that's a consideration, I'm afraid. Sam, we'll be right back with more with the great Sam Faddis right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Memorial Day is more than just a time to remember the sacrifice of fallen American heroes. It's a living testament to the essentiality of practicing peace through strength to prevent needless wars and to win those we must fight. Yesterday, Secretary of State Tony Blinken delivered a speech about China antithetical to that time-tested philosophy. He failed even to mention the unrestricted warfare the Chinese Communist Party has waged against us for decades, let alone the growing prospect of its imminent military action. Instead, Blinken focused on cooperation and competition, the sort of submissive blather one would expect from the former director of the Penn Biden Center, which received some $54 million in anonymous Chinese donations. Such pap speaks at best of what Dr. Bradley Thayer calls the fog of peace. At worst, it smacks of betrayal of more than peace through strength. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and we're having what I consider to be one of the high points of our week at Securing America, and that is our visit each week with Sam Faddis, a longtime, well, important national security practitioner in our country, both as a uniformed officer in the United States Army and subsequently as a member of the clandestine service of the Central Intelligence Agency. In some ways, perhaps his most important service to our country, however, is going on at the moment, where he is bringing great clarity through the pages of andmagazine.com at Substack to most of the really challenging issues of our time. And Sam, I want to pivot from the conversation we've just had about the prospects of perhaps imminent Chinese use of force against us, possibly including biological warfare, to talk with you about what I think we agree was an example of them doing it about 2 years ago, in the form of the so-called COVID pandemic. Talk a little bit about that as a dress rehearsal for a more dangerous attack, perhaps, if not actually just that, and how the World Health Organization comported itself in the course of all of that.
Well, look, I don't think there can be any question in a reasonable, rational mind that COVID came out of a lab in Wuhan, and it was the product of gain-of-function research. So whether the Chinese deliberately released that or they're just sloppy, which we know is true, I still am undecided on that point. But it is a manufactured, an engineered disease that came out of a Chinese lab. And whether they intended it or not, what they got out of it is a clear blueprint for how to execute such an attack. And they saw in very vividly, that we were completely inept in responding to it, and basically everything we did made the problem worse. So one way or the other, they got a template for how to do this. The WHO aided and abetted this. And again, it's one of these things like when you see a silhouette of a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier and they're firing missiles at it, you ought to be able to figure out they're getting ready to sink our aircraft carriers. When you see a guy who's a Maoist terrorist, Tedros, who's the head of the WHO, who is completely beholden to Xi Jinping running that organization, it ought to not be a real shock that everything they do furthers the interest of communist China, and they will continue to do that.
Yeah. Sam, let me go back to something you alluded to there. You were talking about the WHO not doing anything particularly useful, that we made a lot of mistakes, many of them at the direction of Dr. Tedros, the Director General of the World Health Organization. Isn't it correct that basically what we did that proved to be so wrong and arguably contributed to the loss of, well, a very substantial portion of 1 million people who have now perished in this country to the CCP virus, is because we followed the China model for how to deal with all of this. And the mask mandates, the lockdowns, the quarantines, the use of inadequately tested vaccines, the mandating of such use, and then the passports to assure that those vaccinations took place. I mean, that's all right out of what China was dictating through Tedros, was it not? And do you agree that that contributed to the problems that you've just described?
That at the heart of the problem, and you are obviously 100% correct, as Dr. Hatfield, our friend, has said many times, we had an existing pandemic response plan. We were in the process of beginning to implement it. It was shoved completely off the table, and we went to a whole series of measures, lockdowns and so forth, that were CCP methodology, had never been part of our pandemic plan. We scrapped our plan and followed Beijing's directions on how to respond to this. That's precisely what we did.
And to the extent that we did, we have in numerous ways not only contributed to problems in terms of public health, and I would argue the needless loss of an awful lot of lives, but we've also seen, Sam, a terrible diminution of our freedoms and the sort of fabric of our constitutional republic. And as this program, as you know, is dedicated to protecting the country we love and the Constitution, we both swore an oath of office at various points in our careers to protect and defend it. What are your thoughts about the status of that constitutional republic we love at this moment, under the not so tender mercies of the Biden administration, to say nothing of these other enemies, foreign and domestic?
Well, there is absolutely no question that the folks who really are enemies of the republic have hit on the fact that all you have to do is utter the words public health emergency, and somehow magically the entire Bill of Rights ceases to exist. And they don't want to give up that power. And I have noted and written about recently the fact that actually if you watch Joe Biden and his administration, what you see is not only that on display, but isn't it amazing how increasingly there is no reference to any other branch of government? Biden talks to the people. He never introduces a bill into Congress. He never asks for congressional support or American support. He issues edicts. Somehow or another, we're really rapidly transitioning into what amounts to almost a monarchy or some sort of autocracy in which the president now legislates. He doesn't administer and he doesn't act according to laws that Congress passes. He just gets on camera and informs us that this is now what we are doing with no congressional action. And terrifyingly enough, Congress just sort of sits there and watches as he does this.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, Sam. We're on the eve of an election. I hope, despite concerns that we've just been sharing about the possibility we might find ourselves at war, and as we talked about in the webinar yesterday, that may well be used as a pretext for interfering with or at least postponing an election we all hope will bring about a course correction for our nation. But you'd think under these circumstances, members of Congress, at least Republican members of Congress or challengers to the Democrats, would be coming forth and making the case to the American people that you need that course correction, you need us to bring it about, or we really do risk the loss of what's left of our constitutional republic.
Yeah, you would think so, but I think you search in vain most of the time to find anyone who is doing anything meaningful to combat any of this, any of Biden's initiative. I mean, on energy, the man is destroying the entire economy, livelihoods, deliberately, admittedly, deliberately crushing our entire energy infrastructure based on whatever motivations. And nobody is doing anything to stop. You got truck drivers who can't work anymore. It takes $2,000 to fill up a semi now. Every time you go to the
pump. If you can find the diesel.
Can find the diesel. Yeah. And nobody's doing anything.
And of course, the ripple effect through the economy is it's not just confined to the energy sector that's being impacted. As you pointed out in a terrific piece at Ends Magazine on your Substack docket, this is going to be affecting food and every other aspect of our lives, including inflation. Sam Faddis, we have to leave it at that, a grim note to say goodbye, but thank you for your leadership on all of these fronts, my friend, and most especially for the clarity that you bring to these challenges and why we must stand up against them. And you're an inspiration to us. Thank you for joining us each week. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week, and a good Memorial Day to you, my friend. Next up, we'll speak to Peter Mikkelvena about what's happening in Britain on immigration and more, and what its insights are for us. Straight ahead.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. A special welcome to our next guest. He's a first-time visitor with us here at Securing America, and he brings a decidedly British perspective to topics of, well, mutual interest, I believe, to the people of Britain and the people of the United States, both of whose countries are under assault, notably from immigration of people who may simply not be assimilable in a way that is consistent with the traditions, the character, and the future viability of these respective nations. His name is Peter Mikkelvena. He is a longtime associate of a man I respect enormously, Lord Malcolm Pearson of Renwick, a British parliamentarian now in the House of Lords, a longtime confidant and ally of the great Margaret Thatcher. He and Peter have been working in recent years, among other things, at Hearts of Oak on a free speech alliance. And I'm hoping we'll talk a little bit about that. But most immediately, I'm anxious to get his perspective on what the Brits have been experiencing in terms of immigration and the impact that it's having on their country and the insights that we can draw from it with respect to our own immigration challenges. Peter, it's good to have you with us. Welcome, sir, to Securing America.
Thank you, Frank. It's an honor to be on your program. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me begin by saying Britain does not have so much the illegal immigration problem that we do, as I understand it. It's mostly that the governments under both the Conservatives and the Liberals, or the Labour Party, I should say, have been admitting large numbers of them, especially the Labour Party, by permission. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I think when from Tony Blair's time, 1997, we have seen a massive influx. And up to then, it's been more or less net neutral, or maybe 30,000-40,000 a year. And now we are, the latest figures is 1 million, which is the highest figure ever. And it is something that's completely out of control. And as you said, it is illegal, but it's state sanctioned. So we have our government encouraging it through our benefit system. And we have, obviously, Britain is an island. And you would think that would make it more difficult. But we have boats coming over nonstop across the English Channel from France into the UK, onto the coast there on southeast England. And often, this is the crazy thing, they're coming over. Often the police in the boats will go over and pull them in, will help them across. It's not pushing them back to France, but there seems to be an agreement between the British and the French officials that we will bring these people in, put them on the shore, and often they're just released. Often they're just released to go into the system. So it is state-sponsored. Well,
this sounds very familiar to those of us who are watching a similar kind of, you know, sort of administrative process being practiced on the southern border of the United States, as you know. You mentioned Tony Blair. He and or his circle have, as I understand it, copped to having deliberately admitted vast numbers of immigrants, mostly, I believe, from South Asia during his time in office and subsequent years, for the express purpose of changing the electorate of Britain so as to assure a sort of permanent dominance in British politics of the Labour Party. It hasn't exactly worked out that way, but what have been some of the upshots of this profoundly transformative demographic change?
Well, you're right. It's really to rig the electoral system. We've seen that change in London, really. London being a melting pot of cultures from all over the world, and it is now predominantly Labour, predominantly on the left. And the Conservatives have more or less abandoned London. Boris Johnson becoming mayor was because Boris was a popular figure, not because he was a Conservative figure. And since Boris was there, we have seen borough by borough change and go fully red, fully Labour. We've just had elections a couple of weeks ago, and I think there were three boroughs that were held by the Conservatives. They all went Labour, I think, including Westminster itself, where Parliament actually is. So there's very little left in London, which is Conservative, which is really
weird. And you actually have a Muslim mayor, of course, reflecting some of that change. And red, of course, it's always interesting, is the traditional color of the radical left. The Republicans somehow got it assigned here in the United States. But when you're talking about red, that's the hard left. And it's in league, I think it's fair to say, with these Sharia supremacist Muslims in Britain, no?
Well, yes, we have a massive problem in the UK. London is maybe 12% Muslim. Lord Pearson has asked questions on this in Parliament about the demographic changes, and we are seeing borough by borough go majority Muslim because of the higher birth rates and because of the immigration coming over. So both of those things mixed together have altered radically large swathes of Britain. And you think of the English countryside, the rolling hills, church bells on every corner. Often those churches, especially in the middle of England, are becoming mosques, where churches are dwindling, mosques are going up in their place with madrasas. And then the whole change that brings to the culture in that area, you see in the shops, you see Sharia councils going up. It's really changed over the last 20 years. We have seen a massive change in the cultures in pockets, which are now spreading. We have Birmingham, the second largest city in Britain, and that will go majority Muslim. I think 8 years is the figures that Lord Pearson had looked at. And as you said, in London,
and many of them already have, as I understand it, Muslim mayors. It's not just London. Is that right?
It's not just that. We have a number of Muslim mayors across, and also Muslims heading up the councils as well. So we don't actually have a lot of mayors in the UK. The system was changed, and we maybe, it was quite a new phenomenon on the late 90s. And we have seen a number of mayors, a number of Muslim mayors, but the council makeup as well, which is local government, and many councillors being elected as Muslims and also Muslims leading it. And as you know, Frank, that in Islamic countries, diversity and inclusion is not really accepted. So when they are given that open door, they make changes to society and they implement their own culture and push out the English culture.
Let me ask you about a specifically egregious example of this, and that is the phenomenon of grooming gangs that have been operating seemingly with considerable impunity. I understand, actually, with the knowledge of the authorities to some extent. Tell us what they are about and what a problem it represents for British society.
Well, this concept will be nearly unbelievable to your audience, Frank, there in the US. But here in the UK, it came came to the public's attention 2011, the front page of the Times, and it exposed that you had groups of Pakistani men, I think 85% are Pakistani men, obviously Muslim men, who in gangs were raping white girls.
Underage, as I understand it. Is that right, too?
Underage. So all the way from maybe from 11, 12 and up, often the 14, 15-year-old group. And these are often girls from maybe troubled backgrounds, rougher areas. And the first prosecution was 1997, but we are now up to 430 men majority men, 98, 99% of men, have been charged with raping girls in groups, in gangs. And the scary thing, the unbelievable part of this is often these are family members. So Muslim families, Pakistani families, are actually passing these girls around their own communities. So they pimp out these girls. And these communities have known it's happening, but you know, the whole shame and honor culture means they don't want to speak. They don't, and they keep quiet about it. So the first time this was made public, 2011, and we had another, every week we have another story that comes out of a group of men. And a couple of days ago, came out, the headline was 8 men appear in court to deny 84 child sex offences allegedly committed in Rochdale, which is the middle of England. And this is happening week in, week out. And when the journalists have delved into this, they have found out that the police knew about it. The police actually arrested some of the family members of the girls who went to the police to plead for them to help these girls. Actually, the police arrested the parents for stirring up hatred instead of going after the men who were carrying it on. So this is a stain on British society that still you cannot talk about.
It seems very much redolent of the submission that these Sharia supremacists strive for. And again, we're not talking about all Muslims in the UK or anywhere else. We're talking about those that do embrace this doctrine known as Sharia, which is supremacist in character and also jihadist in character. That is to say, its object is to spread the faith and the political domination that it aspires to. No one has understood this better, I think, than Lord Malcolm Pearson of Renwick, and I so appreciate the work that you've done with him at Hearts of Oak, Peter McElvina, and I look forward to learning more about particularly, you know, what you're doing to push back against these kinds of predations, and also, not least, what you're doing on the free speech front. There are some really serious threats apparently underway in terms of an online safety bill. And we'll have to come back to you on that one for another time. But both of these are tremendously important topics for us here in the United States as well. And we look forward to hearing more about what you all are doing to lead on it. Thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Michaela Dodge of the National Institute for Public Policy about the Chinese nuclear threat and what that might mean for all of us right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Memorial Day is more than just a time to remember the sacrifice of fallen American heroes. It's a living testament to the essentiality of practicing peace through strength to prevent needless wars and to win those we must fight. Yesterday, Secretary of State Tony Blinken delivered a speech about China antithetical to that time-tested philosophy. He failed even to mention the unrestricted warfare the Chinese Communist Party has waged against us for decades, let alone the growing prospect of its imminent military action. Instead, Blinken focused on cooperation and competition, the sort of submissive blather one would expect from the former director of the Penn Biden Center, which received some $54 million in anonymous Chinese donations. Such pap speaks at best of what Dr. Bradley Thayer calls the fog of peace. At worst, it smacks of betrayal of more than peace through strength. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. There is a very serious, multifaceted danger to what China is up to with respect to Taiwan and more generally to the rest of us. Unfortunately, it's not any longer confined to the non-kinetic nature of that war, the unrestricted warfare in various forms, economic, political, information, subversion, those sorts of things. And unfortunately, it's no longer, it seems, confined in terms, at least in the capabilities side of the equation, on the kinetics sort of aspect of China's military capabilities, to the conventional forces. There has also been a, well, dramatic transformation in their nuclear capabilities. To talk about that, I'm very pleased to have back with us one of our country's duty experts on nuclear strategy and policy and capabilities. Her name is Dr. Michaela Dodge. She is a prime figure these days in a wonderful organization, the National Institute for Public Policy, formerly served for a number of years in the Heritage Foundation and also on Capitol Hill. And we're always delighted to be able to pick her brains. Michaela Dodge, welcome back to Securing America. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Let me ask you, if you would, just sort of level set, what has been going on of late with respect to the nuclear capabilities of China? Here we have a little one in the background, so I know this is a topic that is concentrating your mind, needless to say, in terms of your progeny as well as our country.
Yes, absolutely. China is our most important strategic challenge. You know, it is something that my sons will be thinking about, I'm sure, when they grow up. Lately, China has embarked upon what our various top-level government officials called unprecedented nuclear buildup. There was information revealed about China building as many as 300 silos in China to place intercontinental range ballistic missiles in them. That scale of buildup would mean that Russia no longer adheres to minimal deterrence posture,
if it ever did.
And yeah. It's building up its forces to be on par with the United States.
I think you said Russia, but I believe you meant China in this context. Yeah. And those ballistic missiles, 300 of them, are believed to be capable of delivering how many warheads apiece?
I think it might be up to 10 warheads per ICBM, if not more. So we really are talking about significant increase in Chinese deployed capability.
Yeah. And this is, of course, not the entirety of the Chinese investment in nuclear forces at the moment, is it? It seems as though they're doing it basically across the broadest imaginable front.
Yeah, they for several years now, they've been investing in other parts of what we would call nuclear triad. Their submarine-launched ballistic missiles and submarines, as well as bombers. So they really want to build up robust, survivable nuclear forces, which is something that the United States has not had to contend with respect to China ever.
Right. And in terms of survivability, is it fair to say that these forces look as though they're capable or designed to be capable of a first strike, not simply surviving a retaliatory one from us?
In those quantities, we certainly, I'm sure that would be something that we would be concerned about.
Yeah. I think so, too. In addition to all of this, there is another aspect to the Chinese program that has been underway for a very long time, though it seems to have not gotten the attention that it warranted from our intelligence community until Dr. Phil Carber, a colleague of ours at Georgetown University, and some of his students actually became sort of aware of and wrote up this so-called underground Great Wall of China. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, Michaela, as to how that fits into both the degree to which we are facing a very comprehensive challenge from the Chinese with respect to these nuclear capabilities, and indeed can't be entirely certain about its full magnitude.
Yes, absolutely. So what they discovered was that China was digging up miles and miles of tunnels to be able to move its ICBMs. And having these tunnels makes it very difficult for the United States to know where Chinese nuclear forces are. So it's a way to increase survivability of one's forces. And, you know, one could make a plausible argument to say that it made sense given China's low numbers or purported low numbers of these forces. But of course, it becomes, I think, more concerning issue once we realize that China is going to have these 300 deployed ICBMs and then just incredibly survivable other part of nuclear force in the underground. Now, it also speaks to tremendous capability and prioritization of investments into Chinese nuclear forces, because it is a very expensive mode of deployment for your forces. So expensive, we have never done it.
Well, and certainly I never contemplated anything on the scale. According to Dr. Carber and his team, this may involve something on the order of 3,000 miles of underground tunnels, which is a staggering project of any kind, needless to say, but specifically one associated apparently with concealing and protecting very large numbers, I would imagine, of nuclear forces. Michaela, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk with you about these capabilities that the Chinese have been amassing in the context of the present danger. It seems increasingly impending danger, perhaps, of a Chinese attack on Taiwan or perhaps others, possibly including our own selves, with those nuclear forces or other capabilities. More with Michaela Dodge right after this. Welcome back. We are having a strikingly serious conversation with Dr. Michaela Dodge, one of the go-to resources on all matters nuclear at the National Institute for Public Policy. Specifically, we're talking with her about the nuclear threat we now face and may soon face in even greater numbers from the Chinese Communist Party. And Michaela, I was very keen to talk with you about all of that as sort of a backdrop for an important book that colleagues of yours, Dr. Keith Payne and Matthew Kostlow, recently published, entitled Victory Denial, Deterrence in Support of Taiwan. Because, of course, we're anxious to dissuade the Chinese Communist Party from acting on not only its longstanding ambitions, but its increasingly vociferous statements that it intends to attack the island of Taiwan. And nuclear forces arrayed against Taiwan, for one thing, shorter range so that we haven't even talked about, tactical ballistic missiles and the like, are in the mix as well. Give us a sense of your team's findings about the nuclear threats, among others, that the Chinese are now posing to Taiwan and what we must do to deter them.
Basically, the main problem that we are facing with Taiwan, but also with Russia, which is in play now in Ukraine, is that we lack comparable capabilities on the lower levels of the escalation ladder, in those tactical nuclear weapons, in those intermediate range nuclear weapons. And so if China has strategic parity or reaches strategic parity, like Russia has strategic parity, the concern is that they will be more inclined to use compellents on the lower levels of the escalatory ladder to dissuade us from helping Taiwan. And basically, that's the deterrence asymmetry that we have not had to deal with, and that will be a massive concern into the future. And we are seeing glimpses of those concerns when it comes to the way Russia has been talking about, preventing arms transfers to Ukraine and keeping Ukrainian territory and all that.
You've just very eloquently and elegantly laid out in a sort of specialist's lexicon a phenomenon that I might just simply describe as they think they've got us checkmated now with respect to nuclear forces capable of reaching our homeland. And that may clear the way, as they see it, to using shorter range weapons against Taiwan, for which we really have no counterpart at the moment. And this is, again, feeding in, I fear, to calculations, maybe miscalculations, but certainly calculations by the Chinese Communist Party, Michaela, that they can now act with impunity against Taiwan, having, as I say, essentially neutralized our willingness to come to its aid. Now, some of those are my words, not yours, I grant you, but the point, I think, is aligned with what you've said. And I'm very keen to just get a feeling from you, because we had a really chilling webinar of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, earlier this week, in which we talked about this possibly being no drill, that the Chinese may well be preparing for imminent action against, well, Taiwan and perhaps us and maybe others. So to this point about your new monograph, what are you and your colleagues at the National Institute for Public Policy recommending be done in these circumstances?
So the most important thing is that what we need to do is to come up with a comprehensive strategy. There are diplomatic tools, there are economic tools that are steps that are recommended in that study. And I really commend it to your attention because incredible amount of expertise went into writing it. And also force posture decisions, including perhaps reevaluating the role of missile defense in these regional scenarios. You know, and at NIPP, we have been proponents of homeland missile defense for a variety of very good reasons that you are familiar with. But also regional missile defense will continue to be important in the way we're trying to grapple with this problem and deny China ability to achieve its goal sort of cheaply.
Well, again, this is a subject to which I know we'll return both with you and with others in the days ahead. Homeland missile defense, we've joined you in championing for decades, and shame on us that we don't have it in place right now, because it would definitely, I think, impact the Chinese calculations as to what they can do or threaten to do to us, and perhaps prevent this wholly unnecessary and undesirable conflict. Michaela Dodge, let me just close by saying your work on all of these issues over the years, and in particular on the importance of our maintaining a credible nuclear deterrent of our own, is so appreciated and so urgently needed. I wish I could say I feel it's being heeded as it should be, particularly by this administration. But I know that you and Keith Payne and others at NIPP are on the case, and we're, again, very much in need of it and very grateful for your efforts. I just wanted to say to our audience, you can get a copy of this monograph about Taiwan and what it will take to assure deterrence of an attack by China at nipp.org, a terrific outfit that I strongly commend its work to you. Thank you, Michaela. Come back to us again soon, if you would. And Godspeed with that little one. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again next time, and that you will benefit from these conversations about how to protect the country we love, and then that you will go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.